I'm Brandon Bartnick, and this is the Future of Mobility Podcast.
The Future of Mobility Podcast is focused on the pursuit of safe, sustainable, effective, and accessible transportation of goods and people. Given the critical nature of the world's climate and energy needs, these topics have never been more important, and they're certainly important to me. So, this podcast is a weekly interview series in which I learn from and put the spotlight on the people helping to develop and implement the technology required to move us forward. Who am I? As mentioned, my name is Brandon Bartnick, and I'm an engineer who realized that making a positive impact is the most important thing to me, both through this podcast and my career in the industry. If you're passionate about any of the topics I cover here, please feel free to reach out on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to connect. Also, if you hear anything you like, please consider sharing the Future Mobility with a friend or colleague. This podcast is brought to you by Edison Manufacturing and Engineering. Technology innovation is great, but it doesn't mean anything if we can't bring our impactful products to life, which means we have to build them. And unfortunately, that's easier said than done, especially for startups and evolving companies that need a reliable option for low-volume builds. That's where we come in. Edison is your turnkey manufacturing partner, specializing in build and assembly of highly complex products in annual volumes of 10 to tens of thousands, utilizing an agile and capital-light approach. If you need a trusted manufacturing partner, then please visit us at edison-mfg.com or feel free to reach out to me directly at brandon.bartnick@edison-mfg.com or by visiting my LinkedIn page, Brandon Bartnick. Now to this week's episode. Today's guest is Desmond Wheatley. Desmond is president and CEO and chairman of the board at Beam Global, clean technology innovator, which develops and manufactures sustainable infrastructure products and technologies. We're talking about electric vehicle charging, particularly scalable off-grid electric vehicle charging infrastructure. Think about some renewable energy, often solar, but some other options, providing the energy source for off-grid electric vehicle storage. And so we talk about why this is so important, why this is such an important piece of the puzzle that we're trying to solve as we scale electric vehicle charging infrastructure, how Beam Global has been approaching it for a long time now, and how they're approaching it today. I'll leave the intro short. Please enjoy this conversation with Desmond Wheatley. Today I'm joined by Desmond Wheatley. Desmond, thanks for coming on the podcast.
My great pleasure to be here, Brandon. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting your, I think, unique perspective in this this EV charging and charging related space. So would you mind kind of setting the stage and introducing yourself and also Beam?
Yeah, so I'm Desmond Wheatley. I have the honor and the great pleasure of being the president, CEO, and also chairman of the board of Beam Global. Beam Global is a NASDAQ traded company. BEEM is our ticker, somewhat confusingly, because we're BEAM Global, but the ticker is BEEM, and we trade on NASDAQ. We're a sustainable technology innovation company. It's a bit of a mouthful, but that means we invent, we design, we take through the engineering process, and then unusually, we actually manufacture the products that we invent, design, and engineer as well at the end of that process. Concentrating primarily on the electric vehicle charging infrastructure side of the world. So we make renewably energized, sustainable EV charging infrastructure products, but also on energy security and battery manufacturing. We make our own batteries, which is pretty unique in the space as well. San Diego based. I'm speaking to you from San Diego today. That's where our headquarters is and our U.S. factory for our EV charging infrastructure products. We also have a facility in Chicago where we manufacture batteries. And then we now have offices in Belgrade and a manufacturing facility in Kraljevo, Serbia, opening up Europe, which is the largest market in the world for our products. So truly a global organization, growing very rapidly. And I like the fact that you introduced me as having a somewhat unique perspective, because I suppose I do. Our products have a unique way of approaching the infrastructure gap that exists between where we are today and where we need to be, which with EV charging products. And we're one arrow in the quiver, but I think we're a pretty important one.
Cool. And how long has the company been around, and also how long have you been in the role?
So actually, the company was originally incorporated in 2006, but doing something very different. I got engaged in the first quarter of 2010 as a consultant, in fact, and then migrated to a full-time employee because I sort of fell in love with what we were going to do with it. We decided to change directions and do something new, make some products to charge electric vehicles. And I took over full-time, I think, as a CEO in the first quarter of 2011. And then I took the company to NASDAQ in April of 2019.
Cool. And if you don't mind spending a little time on kind of the history. So back 2011, right, the electric vehicle space, very different from a technology perspective, and then also public perception and knowledge and everything that goes with it. And would you mind telling a bit about the story? So how did you guys come up with, especially when you're going through a pivot, right? The company was one iteration, now changing something else. How'd you come up with the market and the way in which you were trying to serve this market?
Yeah, so one of my many failures is that I'm quite often too early to technology parties. But luckily, I can balance that by saying that I'm less often wrong about it. So there have been a couple of times in my professional career when I've got engaged in new technology, particularly where infrastructure is concerned, earlier than pretty much anybody else was doing it. And I tend to approach these things with a great deal of enthusiasm and energy, and then have to slog it out until the rest of the world catches up, in it, you could say. So back in 2011, when I took this thing over, electric vehicles were a very different animal, as you have just pointed out. There were only about four models on the road, and I'm not talking about different types of models. I'm talking about absolute numbers of electric vehicles. I mean, hardly any of them anywhere. And then I decided to approach the charging industry with a completely unique and rapidly deployed and highly scalable and off-grid charging solution when there really wasn't any market for it at the time. I was, wrong in how quickly it would happen. I thought it would happen a bit faster, but I'm certainly not wrong that it's going to happen. And our growth over the last couple of years has certainly rewarded us for our patience and for our energy and sticking to it over the many years. But I can tell you what, it was tough. We were walking through the desert as wilderness for many years, just trying to keep the company afloat with excellent products, but very little market to sell them into. How did we come to it? Well, it was a personal thing for me. I've built a fair amount of stuff in my life. I've built a fair amount of infrastructure. And what I have learned is that increasingly it gets harder and harder, more and more expensive to do that. Permitting, environmental impact studies, just the general cost and disruption of construction and electrical work and all the other things you have to do, particularly if you're operating in a built environment, which is where EV charging would have to go. You're inevitably going to be digging up streets to run trenching. You're inevitably going to be pouring concrete and going through a lot of permitting and all sorts of other stuff. And I looked at the number of vehicles that exist in the United States and the volume of infrastructure that was going to have to be deployed to do that. The numbers are staggering, by the way. I'll come back to that in a second. And I quickly ascertained that if we continued with a sort of siege mentality, digging trenches, pouring concrete, pulling wires and all that sort of stuff, that there was no way that there would be enough charging infrastructure to keep up with the consumer adoption of electric vehicles. And so we needed a better way. And with that, I set about inventing a rapidly deployed, highly scalable charging infrastructure solution that does not need to connect to the utility grid and doesn't require any on-site construction, thus negating any of the need for environmental impact studies and permitting and site disruption, and solving some other problems too, which I can come back to in a minute. But that was the genesis of it. We invented the product at the time, and it's evolved a lot since then. It's much better than it was. But I'm bound to tell you, I still have unit 003, the third one we ever made 11 plus years ago, sitting in my parking lot here, operating with no appreciable degradation to its performance. So we did a good job first time out, but the product's got a lot better since then.
Oh, and put a pin in a couple of things you said there, because I think there's a few things I'm going to want to come back to. For now, let's talk about the product though. So can you explain? So yeah, end to end, what is this thing, this solution that you provide?
Yeah. So speaking strictly about the EV charging space, because we do, we make a lot of other stuff, but this is where the majority of our revenues come from, and frankly, it's the area that we're most focused on. What we looked at was in the very early days, I mean, literally the whiteboard discussion, we looked at how might electric vehicle chargers be used and by whom. and where? Importantly, was where. And I was concerned at the time, as I've already mentioned, that, the pace of construction electrical work would be problematic. But I was also concerned that EV charging infrastructure would end up being placed where it was closest to the grid, not where consumers would want it. And actually, we can see that today. If you own an electric vehicle, you will have become used to charging behind the dumpsters at the back of a Safeway somewhere. And the reason for that is because that's where the electricity comes onto the property. So that's the cheapest and shortest trench run and the easiest installation. I think that's a terribly wrong-minded way of looking at a what will in the end be a consumer-facing product. You need to put charging where people want it. And so what I was looking for a way was to decomplicate it, remove all the complication around installing this stuff. And that meant coming up with something which would support itself, be entirely self-sufficient in every way, not even bolted to the ground or glued down. So what we do is we convert renewable sources of energy, predominantly solar, although we're now integrating light wind generators into a new generation of products that we're bringing out. We convert sunlight, and important to point out, you don't need direct sunlight. Even on cloudy days, we're making electricity. We convert sunlight into electricity, and we store that in batteries on our product. And then we deliver that electricity from those batteries to anybody's EV charger. So one of the important things to point out about us is, although we're in the electric vehicle charging industry, we do not make chargers, and we do not offer the services behind those chargers either. We make a mounting asset and a source of electricity for other people's chargers. So all the big brands that you may have heard of, the Charge Points, the Blinks, Electrify America, all of those companies have their chargers operating on our products just without the need for construction or electrical work or a grid connection, because we make and store our own electricity.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's certainly a different way of thinking about this industry or this infrastructure gap that you mentioned. This is one of the things that I've struggled with, right? And like this podcast covers safe, sustainable, effective, accessible movement of goods and people. That's kind of the tagline I throw. And electrified vehicles is a big piece of that. That includes how are we developing these vehicles, but then more and more I'm focused on this question of how do we actually implement the tech that we have? Tech's not good enough for a lot of applications. So a lot of boundary conditions for personal use vehicles, more for fleet vehicles. There's lots of places where there should be electrified fleets, but the charging gap is difficult. And as I dig deeper into it and I look into, okay, the grid challenges, and when you look at permitting and the difficulties of renewables, where now you're adding a variable input into a already challenged grid, and you have these kind of transient loads that you're adding to them that are at peak very high, like it's a super complex equation that gets more and more complex the more that you get into it. Feels like, and I don't want to oversimplify it though, but it seems like if you guys could execute on this idea of off-grid, renewable, stable source of electricity that's then available to be deployed, you circumvent a lot of those issues that I mentioned. So I'm sure it's not as simple as it just seems on the surface there, but I mean, the idea makes a ton of sense.
Actually, it is as simple. It actually is as simple as you just put it. It really is. And actually, you've done an excellent job of summarizing what's going on within the industry. Let me give you some numbers, because they're really, this is not a small undertaking, right? This is a massive undertaking. This is probably the biggest infrastructure build out that anybody's alive today will see in their lifetimes. Because we are, in the next couple of decades, we're going to transition from an oil-based economy, gasoline, diesel, and natural gas and all the other things like that. We're going to move to an all-electric economy. And that's very exciting, by the way. It's a great thing for everybody involved. It's going to be less expensive by far in the long run. There are going to be capital costs up front, of course, but from an OPEX point of view, less expensive by far. It's going to be much cleaner. And you don't have to be a tree hugger to care about that. Airborne pollutants kill about 7 million people a year. Whether or not you care about the environment or anything else like that, just cheaper and better for everybody's health. And then, if anybody who's listening to this owns an electric vehicle, they're going to know that the performance and the fun of driving them and everything else like that, far superior. I'm a kind of a gray hair, not just where the infrastructure is concerned. I've been driving electric vehicles now since 2010. I've owned a lot of different types of them. And not all with four wheels. My motorcycle is one of the most exciting things I've ever owned, my electric motorcycle. But you're absolutely right. The fact of the matter is that when we look at the numbers, so let's go back to those numbers for a second. Just under 300 million cars in the United States of America, 1.4 billion moving to 2 billion globally. I'm going to tell you that if you put 10 experts in the room, you're going to get 10 different answers to the question that I'm about to pose. How many plugs do we need for all those cars? Some people will tell you need 1-to-1. Some people will tell you 12-to-1 will suffice. I'm going to tell you that both of those answers, the 1-to-1 is right in certain circumstances. The 12-to-1 will almost never be right. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, as long as most people have. And I'm going to tell you that all of my observations tell me that about 5-to-1 is even wishful thinking. It can be made to work, but it's wishful thinking. So what that means is, for every 5 electric vehicles on the road, you need 1 publicly available plug. Forget about charging at home. That's not going to work for most people. And I can come back to why not in a minute if you want to expand on that. Mm-hmm. But so call it 5 vehicles for every plug. That means that the United States is going to need around 60 million plugs, and the world's going to need 400 million of them. This is a massive undertaking. And then when we talk about availability of electricity, to electrify just the sedans in the United States is going to add about 1 trillion kilowatt hours of demand. 1 trillion kilowatt hours. Now, the entire U.S. consumption in 2022 was 4 trillion kilowatt hours. That's all of industry. That's all of everything. 4 trillion kilowatt hours. So to add another trillion to an infrastructure which is already strained, 25% again, to an infrastructure which is already strained. I don't know which part of the country you're in, but I'm in California. And in the summer, when everybody turns up their air conditioning, we have what we call flex alerts, which means that the utility simply does not have enough electricity to power all those air conditioners. And so they start turning the power off. New York does the same thing, right? In August, people turn the power off. So in lots of parts of the country, we're already at capacity for current baseload, and yet we're going to somehow squeeze another 1 trillion kilowatt hours. And the worst part is those trillion kilowatt hours will not come at the time of day when anybody wants them to. Consumers don't play those games. They'll plug in and charge whenever they want to. So with all of that said, we've got a very large undertaking ahead of us. 60 million chargers required. The whole industry in the last 10 years has deployed about 160,000 over a decade. And we're going to have to get to 60 million in the next 2 decades. So all of those are big problems. And then there's one other thing. Blackouts and brownouts. Vulnerability, the vulnerability of the grid. The grid is magnificent, probably the most magnificent machine ever made by man, certainly the biggest machine ever made by man, the US grid. But it's vulnerable to blackouts and brownouts because it is a centralized type of infrastructure. Anytime you have centralized infrastructure, the vulnerabilities are centralized and enhanced. We know that we deal with blackouts and brownouts all the time. In fact, they cost US businesses about $200 billion a year in lost productivity today. Once electricity is fuel, that target becomes so much juicier for our adversaries. We know the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians have hacked the grid already. We also know that there's been some homegrown efforts to knock out regions, successful efforts. And then, of course, hurricanes and increasingly rough weather events. All of those things are risks. With that said, we clearly need some other means of deploying this type of infrastructure. Decentralized, rapidly deployed, highly scalable, where the loss of 1 or 2 nodes doesn't bring the entire network down. And that's the side of the business that we're in. So I think you put it perfectly well. It really is as simple as that. Solve those problems and you have a scalable, robust, inexpensive solution to add, not to take away from the grid, but to add capacity, speed of deployment and redundancy.
And quickly, so you mentioned the you don't think that at-home charging at scale is going to work. Is that because of the demand side challenges that you mentioned of just everyone bringing it on at their home is going to present challenges, or is there other drivers there?
Yeah, so, I think it was Disraeli that said there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And this is one of these, mine is an industry that's full of those types of statistics where things sound good if you say them quickly enough or put them on a spreadsheet, but they don't actually really work in reality. And this is a perfect example of this. The Department of Energy will tell you correctly that 8 out of 10 EV drivers charge at home. And as a result, many in the industry are breathing massive sighs of relief. Well, this is a problem's already solved, right? Everybody will charge at home. We don't even need to build the gas stations that we had to build for the internal combustion engine cars. Until you start looking at U.S. housing stock, I have done that. So the average U.S. household owns 2.3 vehicles. The average U.S. household doesn't have enough electricity supply to charge one of those, far less the other 1.3 of them. The reason that 8 out of 10 EV owners today charge at home is because EV owners have historically been affluent. People like me, frankly. Large single-family residence, lots of room in my garage, and lots of available electric circuit for expansion of things that the utility previously was thinking about, air conditioning and stuff like that. I can charge a couple of cars at home. This does not describe the average U.S. household, nor the citizens. Lots of people live in apartments. Lots of people live in condominiums. But even those who live in single-family residences don't have sufficient electric circuits to their home to charge 2.3 vehicles. And if they do, their neighborhood lacks sufficient circuit coming from the nearest substation for everybody to do that. So what we ascertain from that is that while 8 out of 10 people, EV drivers, charge at home today, the truth is that that will be flipped on its head entirely. We'll get to a point where, in fact, only 2 of 10 can charge at home. 8 of 10 will have to charge in the public environment. And so that means we cannot rely on home charging on any level to solve the lack of infrastructure problem.
So there's multiple potential bottlenecks that are probably going to catch most situations some before too long.
Yeah. The edge case is always fun to talk about, but where EVs are concerned, early adopters are the edge case. Affluent, prepared to play the game, prepared to go to great lengths to find chargers and do all sorts of other stuff, and sadly, in many cases, have a second vehicle. Do not rely on the EV alone for what they're trying to do. It's fun to talk about, and it looks good on a spreadsheet, but it won't solve for the majority. We're interested in solving for the majority.
And lots of different places that could go, but let's talk back to the product here. Conceptually, seems simple enough of generate some type of renewable electricity, whether it's solar or wind, have some way to convert that and store that on batteries, have a large enough battery that it's buffered, that you're generating enough so that you don't run out and you can put spurts out to charge over time.
Yep.
What are the hard parts in that ecosystem that I just described?
Yeah, so actually one of them that you just mentioned, the last thing that you just mentioned, is one of the toughest parts. We have trained over the last 130 years ourselves and everybody else to expect a fueling experience which is basically empty, full, empty, full, empty, full. That's the gasoline fueling experience. And part of the reason for that is because whatever we want to tell ourselves, going to the gas station is horrible. Nobody really wants to do it. I mean, it always makes me laugh when they call the stores at gas stations convenience stores. They should be called inconvenience stores. You are inconvenienced by having to go to the gas station. And while you're there, they want to sell you some other poison to match the poison you're putting in your gas tank. I'm being very unkind, of course. But I mean, let's face it, nobody would go to the store if the gas station wasn't there. It's not convenient. It's just that it's something to do while you're being inconvenienced by going to the gas station. The result of that training that everybody has is that they are unwilling to think of electric vehicles in a different fueling behavior point of view, which is they want to replicate the gas station model. And this is why you hear so much talk about fast charging. Must have fast charging. We're going to race for faster and faster charging until you can fuel an electric vehicle as fast as you can fuel a gasoline vehicle. They'll never take off. Actually, as an EV owner, what you quickly learn is that charging your EV is far more convenient than fueling your gasoline-powered car ever was. But you have to change your habits. You have to move away from this empty, full, empty, full way of thinking and move to what we refer to as DRR, daily range replenishment. Some more numbers for you. The average U.S. sedan drives 30.4 miles per day, 30.4. 8 out of 10 commuters require 24 or less miles for their round-trip commute. And the average fleet vehicle, and more than half of our business is fleet vehicles, 20 miles a day, pretty typical. Some of them less than 10 miles a day, some of them as many as 30 miles a day. Now, once you understand that, once you think about that, and once you start thinking about fueling your EV more like you fuel your cell phone than you fuel your internal combustion engine, nobody waits till their cell phone's empty and then goes somewhere special and waits around while it fills up. That's what we do with internal combustion engine vehicles. No, you plug your cell phone in while you're doing something else, at your desk, while you're watching television, eating dinner, or even sleeping. And your cell phone's always full because you're plugging it in all the time and opportunistically charging it. This works very well with electric vehicles as well. And so the first thing I think to sort of take away from this is one of the biggest barriers will be to get people out of this idea that they need to rapidly fuel these vehicles. There will be times you need to do that. Don't get me wrong. Long trip, corridor type trip. You're going to drive Chicago to New York or San Diego, where I am, up to San Francisco or something. Nobody wants to sit around for hours while their vehicle refuels. But the rest of the time, you will be able to fuel your vehicle while you were doing something else. Slowly. It doesn't matter as long as it's full when you come back to it and you have enough range. That's better for the vehicle, better for the vehicle's battery. It's better for the infrastructure supplying it. And by the way, it's easier to deploy the type of infrastructure that can do that. So I think that's going to be one of the big things. The other areas were just more technical. That's a behavior thing, right? And it, oddly enough, the behavior thing is the biggest barrier, really getting people over that. They quickly do, though. Ask anybody that owns an EV, and they'll tell you during the first few weeks they were rushing around looking for DC fast charging and a gas station experience until they figured out that there was a charger at their work. And if they just plugged in every day when they went to work, they never had to worry about it again, or if they're lucky enough to do it at home. In the future, there will be ubiquitous, slower speed charging so that everywhere you go, you're able to fill your vehicle up. So to give you an example, average dwell time in a US supermarket, 47 minutes. On one of our slower chargers, with those 47 minutes, you could get half your daily range replenishment just from that one stop at a supermarket. People drive around, they stop in places. Every time they stop for an hour, they can pick up half their DRR, their daily range replenishment. They're full all the time. So I think that's one way it's going to go. But more on the technology side, the biggest barrier for us by far was getting energy storage under control. It's difficult to deploy energy storage in the vast different array of conditions that you encounter in the United States. Actually, US is a great country to do this in because the United States has everything. Got extreme cold, extreme heat, desert conditions, humidity, hurricanes. I mean, there's everything in this country, right? Where I come from in Scotland, you've got wind and rain. Right, nothing else. So you designed for wind and rain, you just solved for everything, right? In this country, you literally have to solve for every conceivable condition that can be thrown at you. Now, batteries, a bit like Goldilocks, they don't like things too hot and they don't like them too cold. We've got to somehow figure out how to keep our batteries and, frankly, the rest of our electronics in that Goldilocks zone. And, of course, the normal way to do that would be to heat them or air condition them. Heat them when they're too cold, air condition them when they're too hot. But that requires energy, quite a lot of energy to do that. And we have a finite amount of energy because we're trying to get all of it from a renewable source in a very small and compact space. And so we don't want to be throwing that amount of energy at heating and cooling because we want to put the energy in the car. So we had to come up with a passive thermal management system, which kept the batteries in the Goldilocks zone, but without consuming energy. And I can tell you that was the toughest thing, the toughest hurdle we had to overcome. There are lots of other things, structural things and electronic things and everything, but that was really the difference between make or break, solving for that. Because without batteries, we can't charge at nighttime, and nobody wants to fuel their vehicle only during the, you know, the daytime.
Yeah, and how about so then the make versus buy strategy of, I guess it seems like you had to develop your own battery system to optimize for your application. Why are you manufacturing? And also, so I assume you're buying cells from someone and then packaging them into the either module then pack or some type of pack and system level.
Yes.
What went into the decision for you guys to manufacture in-house?
Yeah, so first you're right. And of course, lexicon is so important here. You know, when we talk about batteries, we don't mean the cells. Lots of, you know, consumers think of a battery as something that they put in their flashlight or whatever, the AA or the AAA or whatever. That's a cell, and it works pretty well on a flashlight. It's a simple application. But when you really need to manage those cells and the charge and discharge rates and all that, you put them into what we call a battery, which has got a lot more going on. You're right. We do. We buy commodity cells, although we only buy expensive commodity cells, and then we package them into batteries, which have all the other stuff. So why did we do that? Well, we 10 years ago or 12 years ago discovered a company that had some really special technology, a Chicago-based company that had some very special technology around thermal management, passive thermal management. And we ended up being a customer of theirs and a consumer of their product for many years. We found some other solutions that worked for us too, to diversify our supply chain. But what happened was back in, I think it was 2021, I started to get very worried about supply chain. Seems hard to believe it at the moment because of the way the economy is. But at that time, we were genuinely worried that we might run out of batteries. And as a publicly traded company, going to Wall Street and saying, hey, we've done everything right, but we're not going to deliver any product for this quarter because we can't get batteries, doesn't get you anywhere, right? There's no forgiveness at all. And so with that in mind, I put in process the mechanism to acquire the company from whom we'd been buying the batteries. So primarily it was a supply chain defense maneuver. If I own the company, then I can make sure I'm in the top of the queue to get all the product that comes out of it. Therefore, I don't run out. I can keep the parent company happy. But beyond that, the batteries that we were acquiring were not perfect for our use case. Nothing that we acquire is perfect for our use case because no one's ever done what we're doing before. So we're constantly, you know, kind of shoehorning and crowbarring other solutions that are really good, but just not perfect for what we do into our product. Acquiring the battery company allowed us to bespoke the batteries for our product to make them, get them closer to perfection. We got all the patents. But also all the other things that they were putting batteries into, drones, submersibles, robots, micromobility, and all kinds of, all of which are very interesting areas of industry to us. And so it was a multi-pronged effort. And then finally, just on the economics, batteries were the largest single cost contributor to our product, still are, just as they are for EVs. And so when you're paying margin to an external vendor on your largest single cost contributor, that has a significant impact on your economics. If you acquire that vendor, then you get to retain that margin. And we will end up buying that company just with margin retention, never mind all the other benefits that we get from it. So it was a like most good acquisitions, it was a holistic approach with lots of different contributors that led us to the transaction. But the reasons for manufacturing are chiefly that we have a very specified use, very tough use case, and we really needed to make sure that we were putting all of our engineering and science into perfection. No, perfect is definitely the enemy of good in what we do, but it's certainly getting as close to it as reasonably and commercially viable.
And do you then also do the system level assembly and install then all in-house?
Everything, yes. So our product's basically a combination of our own in-house manufactured components that we just can't get from anybody else, and then best of breed off-the-shelf stuff that we acquire from other vendors. I can assure you we lean towards highest quality that we can get. So we, for example, anything that's a commodity, I don't make. So I'm not going to buy a steel mill. I'm not going to buy a paint factory. I'm not going to buy a copper wire factory. Those things are all commodities. Battery cells, you just mentioned, also a commodity. Unless you're making billions of them, you're not going to compete. And the great thing about that is that there are others, very well-funded organizations, who are investing vast sums of money in making those commodities better and less expensive. Solar modules, perfect example. I'm not going to invest in solar modules either because others are making them better and cheaper all the time. I just integrate them into my end product. But the difficulty with that becomes you do end up doing some shoehorning and crowbarring. It's not ideal. So we're actually becoming increasingly vertically integrated. As the demand for our product goes up, we will acquire more technology solutions and replace more and more of the vendor ecosystem that we have with vertical integration. And that's really about perfection for cost cutting and more efficiency. We want to get more energy density into the small footprint so we can drive more miles on the energy that we're converting from the environment. That's a process, not an event. I'm always looking, and pretty much any time you talk to me, you could expect that I'm in the middle of a process.
Yeah, and maybe last question in this vein. So something like this battery company, right? That you acquire. You mentioned you were one of the customers, and that they were serving other industries such as drone. Do you then maintain that part of the business, and suddenly
yes.
You'd be? And how do you handle that then from a strategic perspective, right? So like the right, you want to be focused initially, and you have a huge opportunity ahead of you, and you're trying to scale within this EV charging space. Then you take on this already up and running business that's serving some other things. And it seems like there's a tension there between, great, you can diversify. Also, you're now getting distracted from the main thing. So how do you balance that as a leader?
There was a great deal of tension, and I can assure you that if you talk to any of our employees in Chicago and in San Diego, they would be happy to speak to you for hours on end about the tension. But they're all good people, and they pulled it off. But I mean, just to give you an idea of the level of impact that what you just brought, which is a very perceptive question, by the way, what you just brought up, just the level of impact of that. We acquired that company, and 12 months later, they were producing 10 times more kilowatt hours of batteries than they were when we were acquiring them. And my rule was, you have to do that, but not at the expense of the existing customers or existing business. And they pulled it off. So we did a lot in terms of increasing efficiency. We invested a little bit to help with that process. Great people. Everybody's very... One thing that's really cool about this, Brandon, is we're blessed in that we are in an industry, in a space that nobody is not excited about, at least nobody that comes to work for us. You make these acquisitions and you hire people, and people are like, this is cool. What we're doing is very, very cool. Driving on site, this actually works. You know, we're deploying these stuff that for our customers, the U.S. Army, the Marine Corps, the City of New York, the State of California, Johnson & Johnson, Google. I mean, just on and on and on. Incredibly exciting customers putting our products through the paces and in a transition, which is like something that nobody's ever seen before. This is more exciting than wire telephony to cellular telephony. When you think about it, it's more impactful in many ways. So some of it is just keeping people enthusiastic, and it's incredible what they can do when they're enthusiastic and when they believe. And then you make a little of investment in, you know, we're expanding the space, invested in machines to help the human beings do more work and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, 10 times more kilowatt hours 12 months after we acquired them than they were producing before we acquired them, and they pulled it off.
Yeah, and so if you don't mind, a little aversion, because this is something I had to put a pin in from earlier, the upfront phase, right? So you mentioned that you were early to this market, and there you've proven to be correct that there was a need here and that you guys are serving it in the right way. You were early at it. You mentioned also there's excitement. I mean, we don't know each other super well, but just talking here, it's obvious that you understand this well. You're passionate. You're excited about this. You're energetic. You're excellent at selling this idea in this conversation. And I imagine when you bring employees to internal discussions, that energy, though, sometimes there's a risk, right, of like, if you rely too much on that, and then it doesn't come to fruition as fast as people think. Like, how did you during that transition period, right, where you guys were early in 2011, and you had to wait it out and then wait for the market to mature? How'd you go about keeping the motivation and the excitement around this idea while also living with the reality that you weren't scaling maybe as quick as you thought you would have?
Yeah, so just to start with the first part of your comment, therefore, I am full of enthusiasm for this, and I'm very fortunate in the fact that for things that I believe in, I have nearly endless amounts of energy. On the other end of the spectrum, I'm completely the opposite, right? Anything I don't believe in, I couldn't get out of bed in the morning if I didn't believe in it. So I'm very enthusiastic about this. But as I tell people all the time, also never eat in a restaurant where the chef is skinny, because he's not eating his own products, right? That should be worrying to you. Well, I am the fat chef of driving on sunshine. I've literally been using my own products now for the last 12 years. I've been driving on sunshine for 12 plus years, I think it is now. We have lots of reason for enthusiasm. The only thing that exceeds my enthusiasm and energy for this business is our rate of growth. And so it's justified on that point. But as you pointed out correctly, there were many years when it wasn't like that. It was very tough for many years. And at the end of the day, what we're talking about is money. Somehow, you have to continue to fund the operation, even though you don't have sufficient revenues or profits to pay for the costs of funding the operation. And this, frankly, is one of the areas where the United States reigns supreme globally. We have the most fantastically efficient capital markets in this country, combined with an innovation-driven economy. Perhaps it's less so in reality than people believe, but in general, people in the U.S. really believe in this idea of risk taking and of innovation and of helping, you know, early stage startups to survive so that they can thrive. And you need to understand how that works. Fortunately, I do. I've been doing this for a long time. I've raised a lot of capital in my life, only ever for things that I believed in and things that I operated in. And I have to say that basically what we had was a combination of very committed employees who were prepared to go through tough times, who created great products on a shoestring. Everybody was overtasked and under-resourced to get there. But we were on the right track, and the investment community was able to sniff that out perhaps before the customer community was. And so gave me just enough runway. I'm very careful with money. All the rumors you've heard about Scottish people are true. So gave me just enough runway till we got to the point where things started to take off. And then when things start to take off, funding, you know, if you've heard the old adage that, you know, you can always get money when you don't need it, that certainly is true. The less you need it, the more of it's available to you and the easier it comes. We were able to hang in there, prove our point, prove the products out, win some great customers, and then keep financing the organization to the point where we are now, where we're, you know, we're a growth machine now.
Cool. And so, yeah, on that note, how would you describe where you are now, and what do you think the next 12 to 24 months looks like?
This is how I describe where we are. We're just getting started. We haven't even scratched the tip of the iceberg where this is concerned. Certainly we are a thousand times the company we were just a couple of years ago. We're much more efficient. Trucks rolling in and out here, raw materials coming in, product moving out all day long in a way that we would only have dreamed about just a short number of years ago. But we are still nothing in comparison to where we're going to be. We have a great deal of opportunity and room for expansion in our existing facilities here in San Diego. We're expanding in Chicago right now. And the acquisition I just made in Europe, which, as I said earlier, is the largest market in the world for our product by far. Just put that in perspective for you. 290 million cars in the United States, 405 million in broader Europe. So it's a very much larger market. We got lots of room for expansion there as well. But I think, even in our wildest dreams, we will never keep up with the demand that we're going to see in the next couple of decades. And so that means what you'll see is just expansion from us. And we will look back on these days and think to ourselves, remember, we were kind of a quaint little company. Well, we will not be a quaint little company for very long.
And how do you then, or I guess, is there a balance you're striving for, right? So like through history, I mean, you can look at both examples of like companies who found that it was time to put the pedal to the metal and did it, and then were reaped the rewards after that. You've also found companies that, you know, thought they were someplace and then something changes and then they get a bit of ahead of their skis, and then that becomes a bit of a challenge, right? So like, how do you, obviously that you're excited about that, obviously that you see a bunch of demand. I mean, I haven't thought about this nearly as much as you have, but I tend to agree based on the market, like infrastructure, there's a huge gap. If there is a reliable product that is not grid tied, you could see how there's nearly endless demand if you can deliver on it. How are you thinking about though, trying to find if there is a balance of like, yeah, leaning into that while also not overextending yourself?
Yeah, listen, you're absolutely correct to point out that success is often the biggest destroyer of young companies, right? The thing just starts running away from you, and you don't have the right people in place. It's one of the unfortunate facts of growing a business from nothing is that you often find that the early team members, the people who like being with a very small, very strapped company, they're not very well equipped to operate in a much more process-driven corporate type environment. And you must become process-driven. You must become the corporate sort of machine, I'm afraid. We are. And so inevitably, there's going to be some shift in terms of the people who are involved. And that's sad because the ones who work so hard in the early stages often don't get to really see the fruits of the thing. There's just nothing you can do about that. You cannot try to, you know, force people into a fit that doesn't suit them. I'm very, very cognizant of this idea of not getting over our skis, to use your term, and not allowing success to cause us to fail. The way you do it is you just keep bringing in excellent people. We just hired another CEO. Well, we just hired a COO for the first time. I was kind of wearing both hats. This guy's a machine. You know, he's a former nuclear Navy guy. He was a submariner. He's an engineer, but he's also got a very strong operations background. Just brought in a new CFO, chief financial officer as well. And so what you're constantly doing is you're bringing people in for not where you are or where you've been. You're bringing people in for where you think you're going. And that's sometimes more expensive and a little bit more ambitious, but you have to do it if you believe in where you're going. And we do believe in where we're going. And I think, you know, you are right. The infrastructure requirements are such that we will never be able to meet the demand if we have the right product. Well, we've proved for the last 10 years that we do and that we can scale up, and we're going to have to keep doing it. So I'll just, the final comment I'll make on this, in terms of the balance between do we go get it and grow, and hey, listen, it's time to take a breather and sort of reap the rewards of this. We are so much on the former and not the latter. There will be no rest for us, no rest for us for many years to come. We've all bought into that, you know. And if I lose energy or enthusiasm for it, I hope I'm big enough to recognize I need to step aside and get somebody else in that can keep the machine running, because this is bigger than any individual. It needs to be constantly fed, and it needs to be allowed to expand at the pace that the market demands, and that's pretty bloody impressive right now.
Yeah, cool. It's exciting to hear how you're thinking about it, and I appreciate the perspective. This has been a lot of fun, Desmond. I think hearing about the story, how it's come apart, the challenge in the industry that you guys are solving, how you're going about it. Really have enjoyed your thoughts here. Maybe I'll ask kind of a closing question here. So, one, is there anything we missed in the discussion that you're hoping to cover, or kind of independent of that, anything you're hoping that someone listening to this conversation takes away from this?
Yeah, I think what I'm hoping that people take away from this is that it's really good to recognize that, particularly when you're used to an incumbent infrastructure, new things will come along. You know, that's what's so great about progress. Otherwise, we'd all be sitting by a fire in a cave somewhere. In fact, we wouldn't. We'd be sitting outside the cave, too dumb to realize that if we went inside, that we could get out of the rain, and we certainly wouldn't have had any fire. Right, because nobody would have ever thought about that. So I think the big thing is to be open to this, to recognize that electrification of transportation, to start with, is very good for our economy. It's very good for our environment, if you care about that. And geopolitically, as someone who spent a great deal of time in the Middle East, I can tell you that geopolitically, this is an essential thing for America's leadership, and also just for the globe in terms of calming things down. Right. So the electrification of transportation is a very good thing. And then the tools that we use to make that work, we cannot be relying on the 100-year-old model. We've got to be looking for more vibrance, not just us. There will be all sorts of people who will come up with fantastic and innovative solutions for this. If I may, I just want to leave you with this. For the last 130 years, we've had diverse fuel types, gasoline for cars and motorcycles, diesel for trucks and buses, kerosene for aircraft, and bunker oil for ships. But the fueling transaction has been, and fueling behavior has been identical. You go somewhere when you're empty, you pump fuel into a box, and you part with cash. The transaction's been, it doesn't matter if you're an aircraft in an airport or if you're on your moped in a gas station or on a ship in a port. Same transaction. What you're going to see in the coming years is a move away from diverse fuel types, go away from all those different fuels I mentioned, it'll all be electrons, but you're going to see a fantastic innovation in the fueling behavior and also the business models behind it. Amazon Prime, you can fuel for free if you do certain things. Own an F-150, you can fuel for free as long as you do certain things. You know, all sorts of incredibly diverse fueling behaviors with diverse infrastructure supplying the same type of fuel to you. That's very exciting, and everyone should take advantage of that and enjoy the process.
Yeah, it's an interesting paradigm to think about, and I think a good thought to leave this with. So, Desmond, thanks again. Really appreciate it, and best of luck to you and Beam Global.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me, Brandon. All the best.
Well, there you have it. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Desmond Wheatley. So what stands out? So the first, to me, is Desmond's claim that home charging will not be a viable solution for a large amount, I think maybe the majority of electric vehicle owners. I'm skeptical of some of the conclusions and numbers that Desmond highlighted, and it just didn't feel important enough to highlight it in the moment, given how much ground I wanted to cover in this conversation. So I don't accept that face value some of the specifics of the claim, but the idea carries some weight in my head. And also, I think there's some truth in there. And even if it's not the exact scale that was highlighted here, this is something worth highlighting, right? That when we think about scaling electric vehicle charging, I think a lot of people kind of intuitively, and I think a lot of the reports you see from the managing management, strategic consulting world come out assuming home charging covers the vast majority of use cases. And then, yeah, you need charge ups and DC fast charging here and there to bridge the gaps. What if that's not true? What if you can't rely on home charging due to grid challenges for a long time? You're going to need scalable off-grid solutions, such as what we talked about here. So that's an interesting concept that I've been thinking about since this interview was recorded, and I think I will continue to going forward. The other interesting thing is how this plays into renewables. Right, so we're trying to tackle several challenges, and they're all this is a complex ecosystem, right? The mobility space, the energy space, transportation within mobility, there's many parallel challenges trying to be faced here. And renewable energy generation and use is a good solution for a lot of the things, or at least a good piece of the solution for a lot of things we're trying to solve here. Comes with challenges, though. One of them being the nature of where and how this is. It's very different than a coal-fired or even a nuclear power plant, right? That's reliable, centralized, turn on, turn off when you want. And renewables are not that predictable. They're also not that centralized, and it changes the game. And having solutions such as what we talked about here with Beam Global that tailor or cater to that and are more tailored towards usage of renewable energy as an energy source that can be used for various applications, including electric vehicle charging, is really interesting to me. So I don't know. I have two kind of topics that I still have a lot of questions about, and there's tons of details, but I think that's to be worked out, which I think that's kind of the nature of these kinds of conversations. But those are the two things that are really staying with me from this conversation. And I don't know, it's really interesting work. I think Beam Global is an interesting company. It's an interesting piece of the puzzle they're trying to solve. Really enjoyed the conversation with Desmond here. I hope you did too. Really appreciate listening. And as always, there's more to come next week.
Thank you for listening to the Future Mobility Podcast.